War often produces unexpected transformations of social life, and this one gave America and Texas each an unusual boon. During negotiations with Santa Anna, that wily gentleman told a group of American businessmen, "When I was on duty in Yucatan, I came upon a product which I am sure will make one of you rich. It was called chicle." And thus, chewing gum was introduced into the states. Texas received a gift almost as far-reaching, for in one of Harry Saxon's finest daguerreotypes, he caught the birth of a legend. Panther Comex, hairy as ever, is shown with a barefoot Mexican peon kneeling at his feet. The accompanying story read, "I must confess that I posed this picture the morning after the event occurred. When Colonel Cobb and I went out on the night of the great killings in Mexico City, we were so late that we discovered nothing, so we retired to quarters. But shortly thereafter, I returned to the streets, suspecting that something of moment was occurring, and I came upon the tail end of the slaughter. Comex and his partner Otto McNabb had been shooting anyone in sight, but they ran out of ammunition. Seeing this disreputable peon, who looked as if he might have been one of the murderers of Olson's, McNabb was preparing to cut the man's throat when the latter broke loose, fell to the ground, and began grabbing at Comex's boot. From prolonged use, the boot was in sad repair, and this the groveling man indicated, tugging at it and informing us in some way that he, the peon, was a bootmaker, and that given the proper tools, he could mend that boot. McNabb, who spoke excellent Spanish, put away his knife and interrogated the man. Yes, he carried the universal name Juan Hernandez. Yes, he was a bootmaker, and a good one. Yes, he could either mend Comex's boot or make him one much better. Comex, catching the drift, raised the man to his feet and asked, through McNabb, "Can you make a boot as good as this?" And Hernandez broke into nervous laughter. "If I made a boot that bad, my mother would beat me." In this way, on a night of carnage and at the very point of death, my company of Texas Rangers acquired a bootmaker who now marches with us, tending our shoes. When the Rangers left their transport at Indianola, that thriving harbor on Matagorda Bay, Otto stayed 3 days with his brother-in-law, Theo Allerkamp. Then, on a horse provided by Theo, he started on the long ride to Fredericksburg. His spirits rose as he neared Austin, where he spent 2 days verifying title to his acreage at Fredericksburg. With reassuring documents in his pocket, he started westward, and for the first time in his life took time to appreciate the miracle of a luxuriant Texas spring. Not the ordinary blossoming of trees at Victoria, or the sparse flowers along the Brazos, or that wilderness of minute flowerlets in the Nueces Desert, but the unbelievable expanse of two distinct flowers, one a rich blue, the other a reddish gold. Sometimes they covered entire fields. And not little fields, either. Look at them. How many acres? He was staring at a spread of flowers along the banks of the Colorado River, so many and in such dazzling array that they almost blinded him. Here rose the wonderful bluebonnets of Texas, each stem ending in a sturdy pyramid of delightful blue flowers. Intermixed with them was the only other flower that could make the blue stand out, the Indian paintbrush in burnt orange. Blue and red-orange, what a surprising combination, made even more vibrant by the fact that both flowers bore at their apex a fleck of white, so that the field pulsated with beauty. So vast it was in extent that Otto could scarcely believe that so many flowers, each its own masterpiece, could combine to create a picture of such harmony. "Red, white, and blue," he murmured. "What a flag!" But then he reached the spot where the Pedernales River joined the Colorado, and now he knew he was approaching his destination. And as he climbed a slight rise, he was confronted by a field not of 40 acres or of 80, but of limitless extent. And it was solid bluebonnet and paintbrush, a benediction of nature so prodigal that he could only halt and gaze. Then, slowly, he turned his horse and rode toward home. Benito Garza also went home, but to a tormented scene. Exhausted from long days of guerrilla warfare, he left Veracruz with his wife and three commandeered horses, as weary of battle as their riders. Painfully, the couple made their way through the jungle and up to the Altiplano, where they witnessed the desolation of Avila and the other ruins wrought by the war. They felt a bleeding sorrow for their country, for wherever they looked, they saw the costs of defeat. The punished villages in which they had sometimes hidden, the horribly wounded men striving to master new crutches, children with distended bellies, the ugly penalties paid by those who had obeyed the rash decrees of Santa Anna. During the first 18 days of this bleak pilgrimage, Benito refused to place the blame upon his hero. "No, don't say that, Lucha. Santa Anna had a fine plan, but it fell astray." "His plans always fell astray." "He'll come back, I promise you. He'll land at Veracruz just as before, except that this time..." At the start of the third week, when the Garzas learned from friends in Mexico City how tremendous the loss of territory was to be, more than half the country turned over to the Norteamericanos, he began to admit that his hero had made fearful errors. He could have engineered it better. Lose Tejas, yes, but never should he have given up so much more. When they reached San Luis Potosí, they heard a constant wail of grief, and now the recriminations against Santa Anna became vociferous, for this region contained many who had fought at Buena Vista, and who knew that Santa Anna had fled the battlefield when victory was at hand. As Lucha said, "That last night, Maria and I crept out on scout while you were meeting with Santa Anna. Secretly, along the shoulder of the hill, we could see that the Yankees were retreating in disarray. But when we returned, we were not allowed to report. Women were not welcomed in that tent." How tragic the defeat was! The litany of lost lands carried its own sorrow, never to be erased from the Mexicano soul. Tejas, Nuevo Mexico, Arizona, California, qué lástima, qué dolor. The names formed a rosary of despair, the heart of Mexico torn away and bleeding. As the Garzas approached the Rio Grande before turning east toward Matamoros, they paused to look across the river into the still-contested Nueces Strip, and resting in their saddles, they reached brutal conclusions. Santa Anna failed us. In the present leadership, there is no hope. Mexico will never know peace, and there is no chance of turning back the Norteamericanos. But in the depth of their despair, they saw a chance for personal salvation. And Benito, his mustaches dark in the blazing sunlight, phrased their oath. "The Yankees who try to steal that strip from us, they'll never know a night of security. Their cattle will never graze in peace. By God, Lucha, they'll pay a terrible price for their arrogance. Promise me you'll never surrender." "I promise." Task Force. I believe that all of us, older members and youthful staff alike, looked forward with greater eagerness to our April meeting than to any before. It was to be held in Alpine, an authentic frontier town of some 6,000 population, situated in the heart of rugged ranch country in West Texas. To the south, along the Rio Grande, lies remote Big Bend National Park, with its peaks and canyons, an overgrazed semi-desert in 1944 when it was taken into the park system, but now a miraculously recovered primitive wilderness. To the north, rising as if to protect it, are the Guadalupes, tallest mountains in Texas, and Fort Davis, best restored of the old Texas battle stations. Alpine stands at an altitude of 4,485 feet, blizzard-like in winter, 90 degrees in summer, and its charm lies in its successful preservation of old-time ways. It serves as the seat of Brewster County, an almost unpopulated area about the size of Rhode Island and Connecticut combined, and is surrounded by ranches of staggering size. "Out here, ma'am," said the tour driver, "we never state the size in acres. It's sections. The Baker Ranch you're asking about, it has 55 sections. That's better than 35,000 acres. Midland size, I'd say, because it takes 150 acres of that barren land to feed one unit. A unit, ma'am, is a cow and a calf, with hopefully another calf on the way. So the Bakers, they can't run but 200-odd cows on their ranch, and that's why we classify it Midland. Ransom Rusk had provided the planes to fly us to Alpine, and as we drove from the little airport, we saw two signs which prepared us for what was to be one of our best sessions. Real oil paintings, $3.50 and up. This motel is run by honest native-born Texans. Our meetings were to be held at Sul Ross University, a handsome collection of red brick buildings perched on the side of a hill. And there a real surprise awaited us, for we were met by a short, white-haired, sparkling-eyed man in his 60s, whose face positively glowed with enthusiasm. I'm Professor Mark Burninghouse, Texas History, and we'll pile right into these two ranch wagons. He would drive the lead car, he said, which the task force members would share. Then he introduced us to a young man of imposing build wearing a big Stetson. This is Texas Ranger Cletus McNabb, and if you know your frontier history, you'll remember that one of his ancestors was the legendary Ranger Otto McNabb. And another was the equally famous Oscar McNabb, also a Ranger. McNabb, a handsome young fellow in a pearl-gray whipcord suit, bowed to us but did not remove his hat. To the girl from SMU who had arranged this session, he said, "Staff will ride with me." And to the rest of us, he said, "I've provided maps of the region we'll be traveling." And with that, we headed south along Route 69 to the twin border towns of Polk on the American side and Carlota on the Mexican. It was a journey of 80 miles through absolutely empty land, not even a filling station, but one which, under the loving tutelage of Professor Burninghouse, provided us with an intimate glimpse of a Texas that few visitors ever get to see. I want you to notice the vegetation and how it changes as we drop down to the Rio Grande, 2,000 feet lower in elevation. Then he began an instruction which was shared by intercom with the staff in the following car. Look at the bleakness of land. Only one shrub to an area the size of a football field. When we studied the barren earth, we saw at first only a reddish, rocky soil. But as our eyes grew accustomed to the vast empty space and the arching blue sky, cloudless and perfect, we began to see lone, bush-like plants clinging to the arid earth. They were dark green and had many narrow leaves that branched out like untended hair, forming beautiful globes. Sotal, one of the major plants of our barren plains. Remember how green it is, because later I'll provide you with a surprise. Imperceptibly, the landscape changed, worsened in my opinion, until we were in the heart of a real desert, but not the sandy kind featured in Grade B movies. We call this the Chihuahuan Desert, 800 miles maybe north and south, 200 east to west, and here we have one of its characteristic plants. He pointed to a remarkable growth, a tall, reedy plant composed of 40 or 50 slender whips, each bearing at its tip a cluster of brilliant red flowerlets. The ocotillo, which looked as if it had been thrown together helter-skelter, was appropriate to its bleak surroundings, for only a plant so thin, so conservative of water, could have survived here. "Look," Miss Cobb cried, as we descended into a protected valley. "What can that be?" It was an imposing plant of the desert, a low-growing cluster of heavy brownish leaves, quite undistinguished, except that from its middle rose a thick stem high in the air, topped by clusters of beautiful gold-white flowers that seemed to fill the blue sky. "A special yucca," Burninghouse said over his intercom. "But hold your applause till we climb out of this depression, because then you're going to see what many never see. A forest of yucca, many species, beautiful." I think we watched with a sense of disbelief for we could not associate this tremendous desert with beauty as we were accustomed to know it. But as we reached the crest of a small rise, we saw, spreading off to our right, a vision of Texas that would never be erased. It was so different, so grandiose, that it seemed to represent the state in its original form, before intrusions like Houston and Dallas. It was a small forest of three kinds of yucca. The noble ones we'd already seen, a more beautiful version called Spanish Dagger, and a veritable tree with sturdy, jagged trunk, a cluster of leaves well above the ground, and a glorious collection of white flowers rising high into the air. The sight was so compelling that several of us in the lead car said, "Let's stop." And when we looked back, we saw that Ranger McNabb had already done so in order that his young passengers might see these splendid plants. They had a strange effect on me. I compared them to the delicate garden flowers I'd known when a student in England, and with the carefully cultivated flowers in Geneva. Obviously, they were flowers, but big and brutal and self-protective against the rainless wind. Compared to the pansy or the tulip, they were gross. One handful of their heavy blooms at the end of a stalk seemed larger than a garden of English flowers or a bed of Boston blooms. They were frightening in the awkwardness of their limbs, unkempt in the way their trunks shed. And when Miss Cobb insisted upon leaving our ranch wagon to inspect one of the nearer yuccas, she quickly returned, for a rattlesnake lay coiled at its base. How beautiful they were, those yuccas of the Chihuahuan Desert. How Texan. As we moved past their tremendous forms, we carried with us a new understanding of the West, that bleak and barren land which offered so many hidden rewards. But now we were descending to regions with a much different vegetation, and Burning House assured us, "Flowers that look like flowers, see down there." He was pointing to one of the strangest flowers I had ever seen, or rather to a cluster of some 100 individual flowers congregated into a round, cactus-like globe more than 4 feet in diameter. When I looked closely, I saw that each plant forming the globe had powerful thorns that interlocked with those of other plants to make the globe impenetrable. These proved that the thing was a cactus. But the blizzard of delicate purple flowers proved that it was also a luxuriant bouquet. However, the real surprise was to come. In the autumn, each of these flowers produces a spiny fruit, brilliant red in color. When you peel away the skin, you find a delicious treat. Tastes like strawberries. "What's it called?" one of the students in the rear asked. And Burning House said, "Strawberry cactus." And then at the lower levels, we came upon the plant that affected me most deeply. I saw it first alongside the road, a low, gray, woody bush with tiny, five-thorned leaves. I took it for a weed, but Burning House said, "Let's stop and inspect it." He broke off a branch to show that the interior wood was one of the most vivid yellows in nature. The Indians prized it for coloring their blankets, and I supposed that this completed the story. But he continued, "It's one of our best shrubs, quite precious, really." "What's it called?" I asked. And he said, "Cenizo, but some spell it with a final A. Its more effective name, barometer bush." "Why?" "If we pass a spot that's had some recent rain, you'll see why." And before long we came to such a place, and there a stretch of cenizo had burst into soft, gentle, gray-purple flowers. They were like miniature lilacs beside some Illinois farmhouse, or dusty asters in a Pennsylvania field. They spoke of home and evening firesides. As I looked down at them, imagining how joyously they must have been greeted by Indians who sought their brilliant dye, I felt as if Texas had somehow reached out to embrace me, to protect me from the barrenness of this western land, and I could understand how Burning House had come here fresh from his doctorate at Chicago, and decided after 1 week that this would be his home for life. We would have known only half of Texas had we missed Alpine. Just as I was beginning to feel sentimental about the plant, Burning House threw in one of those obiter dicta which can make travel with a scholar so rewarding. This is the flower, of course, which made Zane Grey immortal. But imagine how flat his title would have sounded had he called the plant by its proper Spanish name, Riders of the Purple Cenizo. Now the talk turned to what Texans seemed to like best, numbers of staggering dimension. We're threading along the great Ramsdale Ranch, 600,000 acres. Or, over there, reaching 20 miles, is the Falstaff Ranch, nearly as big as Rhode Island, and filled with deer and javelinas and mountain lions. But when I asked who owned these ranches, I was invariably told, "Fellow from Houston who struck it big in oil." And I began to realize that no matter how far one traveled from the oil fields of Texas, the pervasive power of petroleum remained. When we stopped for cold drinks at Polk, the forlorn American settlement, Ranger McNabb informed us, "We'll cross into Carlota so you can see what a Mexican border town can sometimes be. But I must in fairness warn you that there'll be other settlements of larger size which are much better. This one is pathetic." When we saw it, we agreed. Four times as large as Polk, it was 100 times more desolate. It was as if the centuries had hesitated, waiting for some revolutionary invasion to burn down the walls. The fabulous wealth of Mexico had not penetrated here, and the streets were mean and forbidding. Adobe houses crumbled, and open sewers went untended. Stores were adorned with broken bottles, and old cars rusted at the crossroads. The railway station had lost its tiles, and the policemen guarding it wore outmoded and tattered uniforms. Carlota, named in honor of a European empress who had gone mad as her husband tried to govern Mexico, wasted in the blazing sunlight, and we were content to go back across the bridge to Polk. At first sight, we had not rated the American town favorably, but now it seemed a beacon of civilization. Ransom Rusk, who had shown in previous meetings that he disapproved of Mexican ways and also of Mexicans living in Texas, said, as we left Carlota, "Now I can understand why they want to slip into the United States. I would, if I had to live over there." Our two ranch wagons now headed northwest along the Rio Grande, passing an adobe fort long vacated, and the dusty town of Presidio, famed for its appalling summer temperatures. Television viewers grew familiar with the refrain, "Hottest spot in the nation today, Presidio, Texas, 114 degrees Fahrenheit." Then we passed through empty land leading to nowhere, and when we paused to drink from our thermos, I asked, "Where are we going now?" The staff members smiled, and Burning House said, "We've a few more surprises for you." I could not imagine what this forbidding land could hold as a surprise, but at the end of the paved road, in what must have been one of the loneliest and gloomiest sections of Texas, we came upon a minute village, Ruidosa, with six houses and a crumbling low Spanish mission, the Sacred Heart, built like a fort, and now moldering in the desert sun. When I saw it, I said over the intercom, "At our first meeting, the governor said we were to probe into every nook and cranny of the state. This is one of the crannies." It still retained its roof, though probably not for much longer, and its facade was sturdy, with a wooden entrance that must often have been barricaded when the Apache attacked. It was an honorable relic, testifying to the courage of the missionaries who had stubbornly tried to pacify this part of Texas. For me, the most rewarding segment of the trip now began, for our cars skirted the mission ruins to pick up a trail which appeared on none of our maps. It wound its way due north for 18 miles along the Rio Grande, so that whenever we looked to our left, we saw the mountains of Mexico. Over the intercom, we heard our young woman from SMU ask Ranger McNabb, "Tell us the truth. Does this trail lead anywhere, or is this a kidnapping?" And he replied, "We're heading for the end of the world." When we stopped, we found ourselves in the adobe village of Candelaria, where the pretensions of Texas and the United States ended. For this was one of the loneliest and most inaccessible settlements along the southern border, with people living much as they had in the previous century. But to me it was compelling, a view of Texas that few ever saw, and my heart beat faster when Burninghouse said, "Imagine an international border, and from here, for more than 100 miles, nothing." But what delighted our staff was the fact that when we strolled down to the Rio Grande, that river with the magical name, it was so narrow and shallow that a tattered rope-and-wire suspension bridge sufficed to cross it. And as we looked, a pantalooned workman from Mexico, carrying a battered gasoline tin with handles, came across its swaying planks to purchase some commodity in Candelaria. "Behold, the commerce of great empires," Burninghouse cried. And we stood silent, confused by the hugeness of Texas and the meanness of its historic river. I think we were all gratified when Burninghouse explained the anomaly. "We Americans in New Mexico and Texas take so much water out of the Rio Grande for irrigation that if this little stream were allowed to run toward the Gulf in this condition, it would simply disappear. But at a spot near Presidio, a large Mexican river joins up, the Rio Conchos. So the fabled Rio Grande, which we admire so much downstream, should more accurately be called the Conchos. It's mostly Mexican." Then came a clatter from the town, and he said, "I think they've arrived." And when we returned to our cars, we found that students from Sol Ross had brought a picnic lunch for us and had spread it on blankets under a tree. "There will be no speeches," Burninghouse assured us. "I wanted you to imagine yourselves as Spanish immigrants coming here to settle 400 years ago. I wanted you to see the great empty Texas that they saw." On the trip back, following an unmarked trail through mountains and canyons, I noticed that Burninghouse maintained a sharp lookout, and finally he announced, "If I remember correctly, it's in the next valley that our little cheerleaders climb the hillside." And when we reached the crest from which we could look across to the opposite hill, we saw a bewitching sight, for the entire hill from creek to crest was covered with something I could not identify. "Look at them. The golden leaves at the bottom, the beautiful green at the top. And tell me what they are if they aren't a gaggle of girl cheerleaders in the stadium on a bright autumn day." From a distance, that's what they were, a host of girls in the green and gold of their team, scattered at random over a sloping field of some 50 acres, as jaunty a performance as nature provided. "What are they?" one of the students asked. And Burninghouse said, "Sotols. Dead leaves, golden at the foot, new leaves, green at the top. I feel better about life whenever I enter this valley." So, for 60 miles along a forsaken road, we picked our way toward Marfa, one of the choice cattle towns of the West, with a flawless courthouse. There we turned east, and when we reached the outskirts of Alpine, to which most of us now wanted to move, we saw our third sign. UN out of U.S., U.S. out of Texas. Chapter 9. Loyalties. As soon as it was consonant with his understanding of military honor, Percifer Cobb resigned his commission in Veracruz. But when he submitted his papers to General Scott's aide, Brigadier Cavendish of Virginia, the latter tried to dissuade him. "Colonel Cobb, since the days of Washington, we've always had a Cobb among our leaders. We can't let you leave." "I will never again accept the humiliation I've had to suffer in this war. Deprived of a rightful command, sentenced to work with those Texans. Are you aware that we've sent your name up for promotion?" "Too late." "You mean you won't accept it if it comes through?" Cobb was polite but resolute. "No, sir." He thanked Cavendish for his concern and was about to leave when the brigadier pushed back his chair, rose, and took him by the arm. "Perse, my dear friend." In the formal discussion, it had been Colonel Cobb, as was proper, and this sudden switch to the familiar, unnerved Percifer, who mumbled, "Yes, sir," with the respect he always accorded superior rank. "Could we walk, perhaps?" "Of course, sir." In the public park that fronted the sun-blinded Gulf of Campeche, the two officers stared for some moments at that bleak fortress out in the bay, San Juan de Ulua, where Mexican prisoners sentenced in Veracruz rotted in their dark dungeons. "How would you like 7 years in there?" Cavendish asked. "I have much different plans." "Then you won't change your mind? You're definitely leaving?" "I decided that 2 years ago, at least." "And I understand your bitterness. But do you understand why we cannot lose you?" "I can think of no reasons." "I can." Very cautiously, the Virginian looked about him, as if spies might have been planted even in this Mexican port city. Taking Cobb by the arm, he drew him closer and said in a conspiratorial whisper, "Many of us are looking ahead." Then, fearing that Cobb was not alert enough to have caught the signal, he continued, "We're on a collision course." "Meaning?" "Two irresistible forces, south, north." "You think?" "I see it in signs everywhere. I read it in the papers. Even my family hints when they write." "Is it that bad?" "Worse. The North will never stop its aggressive pressure, and if it intensifies, as I'm sure it will, we'll have to leave the Union, and that means..." Cobb had not interrupted. The brigadier had hesitated because, as a loyal officer, he was loath to utter the word. So Cobb said it for him. "War?" "Inevitable. And that's why it's important to keep in uniform, because when the moment of decision comes..." Cobb, reluctant to contemplate another war, so soon after finishing one he had found so distasteful, tried to end the conversation. But Cavendish, having parted the veil that hid the future, kept it boldly open. "Each man in uniform will have to decide. Men like me will fight for the South till snow covers Richmond 60 feet deep. Stupid bullies like some we know, they'll stay with the North. I suppose men like Robert Lee will, too, out of some sense of loyalty to West Point. But really able men like Jefferson Davis, Braxton Bragg, Albert Sidney Johnston, they'll give their lives to defend Southern rights, and you must be with us." "I'm still sending in my resignation," Cobb said, and he returned to his quarters, where packing had to be completed before reporting to the waiting ship. When he stepped ashore at New Orleans, a civilian, and saw the mountain of cotton bales ready for shipment to Liverpool, where world prices were set, he was eager to hurry back to his family plantation on Edisto Island and assume command of its cotton production. Prior to enrolling at the Point, he had known a good deal about cotton, for the Cobb plantation had, for many decades, produced the best in the world, the famed Sea Island, with the longest fibers known, and a black shiny seed which could be easily picked clean even before the invention of the gin. As soon as he had located a hotel and arranged for his journey northeast, he asked the way to the offices of a journal which his family had read since 1837, and to which cotton growers looked for guidance. When he introduced himself to the editor of New Orleans Price Current, a scholar from Mississippi, he was warmly greeted. "A Cobb from Edisto. Never expected to see one in my office. You are most welcome, sir." "I'm returning home after military service and wanted to learn how things are going in the trade." "Never worse." "Do you mean it?" The editor slid his yearly report across the desk, and before Cobb had finished the third paragraph, he grasped the situation. The commercial revolution, which had prostrated credit in Great Britain, and which subsequently spread to nearly all parts of the continent of Europe and to the Indies, put a sudden check to our prosperous course. A still more severe blow was given by the startling intelligence of a revolution in France and the overthrow of the monarchy. This movement of the people in favor of popular rights rapidly spread to other countries of Europe, and in the tumultuous state of political affairs, commercial credit was completely overthrown and trade annihilated. All this produced a more rapid depreciation in the price of cotton than we remember ever to have witnessed. At Liverpool, sales were made at lower rates than were ever before known for American cotton. Many English mills simply shut down, while others were compelled to resort to part-time working. Cobb, feeling his mouth go dry, asked, "How bad is it?" And the editor handed him the price report for middling as sold at New Orleans. Here's how bad it is. As Cobb took the paper, he asked, "What do you figure it costs to raise and deliver a pound of cotton these days?" And the expert replied, "With care, 7 cents." When Cobb saw the record, he felt dizzy. 3rd of September, 1847, 12 5/8 cents, and a modest profit. 26th of November, after the first flood of bad news, 7.5 cents, right at the no-profit level. 28th of April, 1848, when Europe was falling apart, 6 cents, which meant a cash loss on each sale. "Do you see any relief?" Cobb asked, and the editor pointed to his explanatory notes for this dismal year. The Royal Bank of Liverpool suspended business. Numerous business houses of great antiquity and reputation closed. Many contracts with American shippers voided without recourse. Forced abdication of King Louis-Philippe from throne of France. All Europe in worst condition since 1789. Angry mobs of Chartists threatened the peace in England. Population of Ireland in an unruly mood. "Surely," Cobb protested, "our marvelous victory in Mexico must have affected the market favorably." But with his ruler, the editor pointed to a minor note at the very end of his gloomy report. "This shows how the rest of the world evaluated your war. Our own war with Mexico was brought to a successful close by Mexico's cession of California, etc., to the United States." "What can be done?" Cobb asked. "You long staple Sea Island men, you don't have to worry." He showed Cobb his summary. "South Carolina short staple, 280,671 500-pound bales, 7 9/16 cents. They lost a fortune on that. Sea Island long staple, 18,111 bales, much of it from Edisto, price held reasonably firm, 19.5 cents. And there was the difference. Short staple, 8 cents. Long staple, 19 cents. And Edisto grew only the long. Other plantations, of course, would have grown Sea Island had their land permitted, but it did not, and they were condemned to growing the more difficult and less profitable short. "Haven't you a brother in Georgia who grows short?" the editor asked, and Percifer smiled. "A cousin. My father's brother became insulted over some fancied grievance years ago, about 1822, if I recall, and off he trundled to Georgia, predicting that he'd make a fortune. But, of course, he couldn't grow Sea Island up in those red hills. He was stuck with short, and he's never done too well with it." "Why didn't he return to Edisto?" "When a Cobb leaves, he leaves." "Did you say you were leaving the army?" "I did." "But in case of trouble..." The editor paused exactly as Brigadier Cavendish had paused. Cobb, who had refused to consider such a possibility in Veracruz, now responded as an honorable soldier would. "If real trouble threatened the Union, of course I'd report. So would you." A long silence ensued, and it was obvious that neither man wished to be the one to break it. Then the editor surprised Cobb by switching subject matter dramatically. "Your cousin in Georgia should study this," and he shoved a provisional report into Cobb's hands. "I was going to print it in this year's summary, but I wanted to verify some of the amazing statistics." And Cobb read, "Average yield per acre, actual, of cotton crop in 9 states. Florida, 250 pounds. Tennessee, 300 pounds. South Carolina, 320 pounds. Georgia, 500 pounds. Alabama, 525 pounds, Louisiana, 550 pounds, Mississippi, 650 pounds, Arkansas, 700 pounds, Texas, 750 pounds. "Could these figures be real?" Cobb asked, astonished by that last line. "We think so," the editor said, "but we're going to double certify. If they prove out, we'll print them. So you and your cousin both ought to move to Texas. Looks as if it's to be our major cotton state." When Cobb started to ridicule the idea, the editor returned to his gloomy summary, tapping it with his pen. "The lesson, Cobb, is that cotton prospers, and you and I prosper, when things around the world are kept in order. Why would the French throw out a perfectly good king? Why would the damned Chartists raise trouble in England, along with those idiotic revolutionaries in the Germanies and the Austrian Empire? For that matter, you tell me why the abolitionists are allowed to rant and rave in this country. They'd better not rant and rave in South Carolina." In swift, inevitable steps, Percifer Cobb had progressed from being against any war to defending the Union in case of trouble to championing the South. "The world would be so much better off," the editor said, "if only people would remain content with things as they are. Tell me, in Texas, did you hear any agitation against slavery?" "In Texas, I heard nothing except the buzz of mosquitoes." "I envy you that plantation on Edisto, one of the world's best. I aim to keep it that way." Edisto Island was a low-lying paradise formed in the Atlantic Ocean by silt brought down the Edisto River, a meandering stream that wound its way from the higher lands of South Carolina. An irregular pentagon about 10 miles long on the ocean side, the island's highest elevation was 6 feet, and its dominant physical characteristic, large groves of splendid oak trees, some deciduous, but most live, which were decorated with magnificent pendants of Spanish moss. Its fields were miraculously productive, with soil so soft and even that it could be plowed with a teaspoon. About 50 white people lived on the island's great plantations, and 1,500 black slaves. Except for small family gardens and some acreage of rice, the only crop grown was Sea Island cotton, sown in March, ginned in September, shipped to Liverpool in Edisto ships in January. Every white family who owned a plantation home on Edisto, handsome affairs with white pillars supporting the porch, also maintained a grander home along the Battery in Charleston, 24 miles away. In that congenial city, the spacious life of the Carolina planter unfolded, and Cobb was most eager to renew his acquaintance with it. Both his father and his wife would be in Charleston, and he longed to see them, but he felt it his duty to report first to the plantation, where his brother would be in charge. He liked Somerset, 4 years younger than himself, and had felt no qualms about turning the plantation over to him when he enrolled at West Point. His letters from the Mexican War had testified to their continuing rapport. They were more like those of a friend than of an older brother, and he was impatient to see Set, as the family called him. He therefore ended his homeward journey at a road junction some 20 miles west of Charleston. Here the Cobbs maintained a small shack in which lived an elderly slave whose duty it was to drive members of the family down the long road to the ferry that would carry them across to Edisto. This slave bore the extraordinary name of Diocletian, because an earlier Colonel Cobb had loved Roman history, believing the gentlefolk of the South to be the descendants of Romans. He had named all his house servants after the emperors, except his personal servant-butler-valet, whom he invariably called Suetonius, on the logical grounds that Suetonius was responsible for all we know about the first Caesars. He wrote the book. So you, Suetonius, damn your hide, are responsible for all the Caesars in this house. He usually worked it so that he had 12 house servants, which permitted him to make the joke, "My Suetonius and his 12 Caesars." Diocletian, an artful one-time house slave who knew that his welfare depended upon keeping various masters pacified, created the impression of being deliriously happy at seeing the colonel home from the wars. "Get them horses," he shouted at his sons. "We gwine carry General Cobb to the ferry." But when he was alone with his aged wife, he predicted, "Old stiff and steady, back with his big ideas, don't look good for Somerset." Rapidly, a buggy was prepared, and with Cobb holding the reins, he and Diocletian started the pleasant 9-mile ride to the ferry. As they rode, the slave spoke of events on the island, and since he had for some years served as a house servant, He could speak English rather well. But he was basically what was called a Gullah nigger, and as such used the lively, imaginative Gullah language, Elizabethan English spiced with African coast words. Since Cobb had learned it as a boy, he encouraged Diocletian to use it as they talked of familiar things. Itifum, he stole it. Antelum shum, until I saw her. Wafa sha'ap, why is she so smart? Haka imfara entwat, how come his father isn't worth much? Umlak bukra bittel, he likes white man's food. By and by, e gwine weda pontak idisto. By and by, it's going to rain upon Idisto. But now, as they passed the interminable wetlands, whose lazy waters and wind-blown reeds pleased Cobb, for he had not seen them in 5 years, Diocletian switched subjects, and as he spoke of Cobb affairs, he used English. You wife, Miss Tessa May, she never better. Set's wife, Miss Millicent, she not too well. Two churins now. Boys, aren't they? Boy and a girl, both fine. Diocletian said that he himself had two grandchurin, both fine. When the buggy approached the ferry, he began to shout and snap the whip, which he had taken from Persever, and in this way he roused the boatman, who also gave the impression of being delighted to see the colonel after such a long absence. How dem Mexicans, he wanted to know. Dem Mexican women's, they all dancy-dancy like they say? The three men discussed the war, after which Diocletian bade his master farewell. We hopes you bees here long time, Colonel. This year is you home. In fluent Gullah, Persifer thanked the slave for the pleasant ride, and immediately thereafter boarded the ferry, allowing its keeper to pole him across the shallow north fork of the Edisto River. Before the little craft landed, slaves on the island side had saddled a horse for the colonel, dispatching one boy on a mule to alert the big house that Persifer was about to appear after his long absence. Down the tree-lined roadway the boy sped, kicking his mule in the sides as he shouted to everyone he met, "Colonel Cobb, he come home!" It was about 7 miles from the ferry landing to the gracious two-story white house, in which Somerset Cobb, as plantation manager, lived with his wife Millicent and their two children. And as the ride ended, it became apparent that the messenger had spread his news effectively, for everyone inside the house, and from outlying workhouses too, had crowded beside the long lane leading to the colonnaded porch, prepared to give him the kind of enthusiastic welcome he expected. 10 whites and about 50 blacks stood waving as he and his attendant cantered through the spacious gateway. Modestly, but with no excessive show of subservience, the slave slowed his horse and stopped it by the side of the roadway, while Persever rode on ahead, wearing the uniform of his country, but with no insignia marks to show that he had once been a colonel. He stopped and gazed in surprise, for from the porch came someone he had expected to be in the more salubrious climate of Charleston. It was his wife, Tessa May, daughter of a leading Carolina family, a slim, self-possessed young woman who rarely said anything thoughtlessly, and for that reason commanded his attention as well as his affection. "Darling," he cried, "how wonderful to see you!" Easily he swung his right leg free of the saddle, leaped to the ground, and took her in his arms. Over her shoulder he saw his brother, a bit heavier now, but with the same manly appearance he remembered so well. He was dressed, Persever was glad to see, in expensive boots from England, trim trousers made to order by a Charleston tailor, an open-necked shirt of good French cloth, and a soft beige scarf from Italy tied loosely about his neck. He was a fine-looking fellow of 31, rather retiring in disposition, who appeared to have managed plantations all his life and intended continuing. Although he was quiet, there was about him none of the softness which so frequently attacked second sons of planter families when they realized they would not inherit the family estate, and life goals became indistinct. It was also apparent that he liked his older brother very much, and he now waited for a proper chance to show it. "Somerset," the colonel cried, moving on to his brother, "I've thought of you and this house whenever I sent you a letter." "How wonderful they were!" Millicent Cobb interrupted as she moved forward to receive an enthusiastic kiss. "You should be a novelist, Percifer. I could see your panther Comax coming at me through the woods." "That would be a very bad day for you, Lissa, when that one came at you." "Did he wear a panther cap?" the Cobb boy asked. And Percifer said, "Indeed he did, and he smelled like a panther, too." Turning to his wife, he asked, "And where are our children?" And she replied, "At school, in Charleston." It was quickly agreed that the four older Cobbs would leave at once for Charleston to go to the great house on the Battery, and orders were sent to the plantation ferry, a much different one from the general ferry which Percifer had used to get to the island, to prepare the boat and the rowers for the delightful voyage to that golden city of the southern coast. But now Millicent, who seemed frail in everything but determination, put her foot down. "We shall not go today. Percifer is tired, whether he realizes it or not, and we can go just as well in the morning." However, the brothers felt that servants should be sent ahead in a smaller boat to alert their father of his son's return, and Millicent saw nothing wrong with that. "I'd have preferred a surprise, and so would father, I judge, but let it be." Talk turned to cotton prices, and Percifer reported what the New Orleans editor had said about how adverse conditions in Europe affected them. "What the German barons ought to do," Percifer said, "is line those agitators up and spread a little canister about. Give them time, they will." They both thought it unfair for peasants in Europe, and especially in Ireland, to be causing disturbances which unsettled the Liverpool market. And Somerset was astounded when his brother informed him of the collapse of Liverpool's Royal Bank. "Good God! Rioters tearing down a great bank!" "I was damned pleased, Percifer, when you told us how your Texans handled those rioters in Mexico City. What they need in Europe is about 6 regiments of Texas Rangers." "Please," the colonel said, "don't send them anywhere, not even to the Ottoman Empire." Later in the evening, when the brothers were alone, each realized that he should speak openly of the altered situation on the plantation now that Percifer had resigned his commission. But each was loath to broach this delicate question, so Percifer raised one of more general significance. In New Orleans, men spoke openly, well, not directly, but you knew what was on their minds. They spoke of a possible rupture between our oppressors at the North and ourselves. Have you heard any such talk, Set? There's been constant talk since I can remember, but only by the irresponsibles who seem to flourish in this state and Georgia. Men like you and me, we'd surrender many of our advantages if we broke with the North. Have we any advantages left? Cotton. Every day I live, every experience I have, proves anew that the rest of the world must have our cotton. Cotton is our shield. Even when it can drop from 12 5/8 to... What price did you say our upland people got? 4 cents plus? That's a 2/3 drop in 3 months. And we'll see it back to 20 cents as soon as peace is regained and the mills resume weaving. He leaned forward. If a man grows Sea Island, he worries far less, and we grow Sea Island. On that reassuring note, the brothers went to bed. They rose early, walked down to the plantation landing, entered their long, sleek craft, its 6 slaves already in position, and started one of America's outstanding short voyages. When they left the pier, they had a choice of 2 routes. They could head east and soon enter the Atlantic Ocean, where a rough 30-mile sail would carry them to Charleston. Or they could head west and enter a fascinating inland passage that would take them to the same destination, except that on this route, protecting islands would hold off the Atlantic swells, making the voyage a sea breeze delight. If the brothers had been sailing alone, they would surely have taken the open sea route for its challenge. But, with their wives aboard, they chose the inland passage, moving through vast marshes until they saw above them the headland on which rested the beautiful homes and imposing trees of Charleston. Now, with the wind gone, they dropped sail, and the slaves, their back muscles glistening in the sun, leaned on the oars, their voices blending in a soft chanty as they moved the boat toward its docking place near the battery. "Miss Lucy, don't you bake him no cornbread. Don't you feed him like you done feed me. Miss Lucy, don't you dare bake him no cornbread till I comes home with your two possum." When they broke out of the narrow channel and into the glorious bay which made Charleston so distinctive, they could see, dead ahead, the glowering walls of Fort Sumter, unassailable on its rock. And while the sails were being hoisted again, Persifor told his listeners of San Juan de Ulua, a comparable fortress set in another part of the same great ocean. With deft moves, the black helmsman brought the craft about and landed his four passengers on the battery, one of the nation's majestic streets. It stood on a hill so low it scarcely merited its name, but so pleasingly high that any house atop it caught a breeze off the sea. The stately houses were not positioned like those of any other American street, because a house was taxed according to how much of the precious battery it took up. The Charleston mansions were not built with the long axis facing the sea, which would have been reasonable, but with the shortest end possible facing east, and the longer sides running far back into the town. "Charleston has always looked sideways at the world," Persifor said, as he saw once more those homes in whose pleasant gardens he had spent the better hours of his youth. There was the master's mansion, in which he had courted Tessa May, and farther along the Brooks house, where he and Somerset had gone so often to visit Millicent Brooks and her sister Nettie Lou. For almost a year it looked as if the two Cobb boys were going to marry the two Brooks girls, but then Nettie Lou met a dashing boy home from Princeton, and Persifor had to settle for the master's girl. Out on the great plantations and along the battery, it seemed as if a Charleston man did not marry a specific young lady on whom his fancy fell. He married the heiress to some other plantation, some other mansion along the seafront. The Cobb mansion, which at the present had no girls to marry off, but which soon would when Somerset's daughter matured, was from the street a modest red brick structure of three stories, with two ordinary-looking windows on each floor, but no door for entrance. A stranger to Charleston's ways, seeing this plain facade for the first time, would glean not the slightest indication of the quiet grandeur hidden behind the plain walls. But let him move slightly to the left and enter the beautiful wrought-iron gate, set between two very solid brick pillars, and he would come upon a fairyland of exquisite gardens, elegant marble statues from Italy, and brick sidewalks wandering past fountains, all enclosed by the long, sweeping, iron-ornamented porch on the right and the high brick wall on the left. The wall, about 10 feet high, was a thing of extraordinary perfection, for its bricks were laid in charming patterns which teased the eye along its immense expanse, and it was finished at the top in graceful down-dipping curves whose ends rose to finials on which rested small marble urns. On a hot afternoon, one could sit on the long porch sipping minted tea and study the variations in the wall as one might study a symphony or a painting. The porch was the masterwork of this excellent house, for it ran almost 30 yards, was 2 stories high, and was so delicately proportioned, resting on its stately iron pillars, that it seemed to have floated into position. Wicker chairs, placed about round glass-covered tables, broke the long reach into congenial smaller units that could be comfortably utilized by any number of visitors from 1 to 20. Flowers adorned the porch, some planted in beds along its front, some in filigreed iron pots hanging decorously from the posts. But its salient characteristic was its sense of ease, its promise of shade on a hot day, the glimpses it provided of the nearby bay, and its constant invitation to rest. When the Cobb brothers came through the gate, they saw, resting on this porch at one of the smaller enclaves, their father, Maximus Cobb, 72 years old, his two canes perched against an unused chair. White-haired, with a prim white goatee but no mustache, he was dressed wholly in white, from his shoes to the expensive white Panama resting on a table which also held his mid-morning tea. He did not rise to meet his sons, for to do so would have necessitated use of his canes. But he did extend his hands to Persifer, holding on to his older son for some moments, with obvious delight and love. "Suetonius," he called, "come see." But Suetonius, a slave now in his late 60s, and weighted down with dignity, did not appear. In his place came a moderately tall, handsome black man in his early 30s, very dark of skin, with close-cropped hair, flashing eyes, and a constant smile that showed extremely white teeth. He was not amused by the life about him, for he was painfully aware of being a slave. But he did prefer easing each day along with a minimum of difficulty, and he had found that the simplest way to accomplish this was to smile, no matter what absurdity was thrown at him. Now, although he spoke good English, he used the dialect expected of him. "Suetonius, he working wid de cook." "Trajan," Colonel Cobb cried as soon as he saw the graceful figure appear in the doorway, and the slave, having been forewarned by yesterday's messenger that the young master of the plantation was to arrive, smiled with genuine affection and stepped forward to clasp the extended hand. 3 years younger than Persifer, a year older than Somerset, Trajan had grown up with them, had played with them at wild games along the marshes of Edisto, and, at their suggestion, been brought into the Charleston mansion and given a Roman name. He had always liked the boys, finding in them not a single mean streak that the young men of Charleston sometimes displayed in their treatment of blacks, and he had never quailed when one of them became momentarily angry in some game, shouting at him, "You damned nigger, I'll break your kinky head." When they had tried, he had fended them off with ease, knocking them about until everyone collapsed with laughter. Under their tutelage, he had dropped his gullah to acquire proper English, and under his teaching they had learned gullah, which helped them enormously in dealing with the field hands. He now looked approvingly at the almost emaciated body of his friend Persifer, so debonair in his military uniform, and cried, "He come home." These simple words, spoken so obviously from the heart, touched Persifer deeply, and he gripped his slave's hand more tightly. Maximus Cobb felt, with some reason, that he had only a limited time to spend in any day, for he required long naps, or in the passage of life itself. So with no embarrassment, he asked Trajan to tell Suetonius to have the slaves rearrange the porch and move 4 chairs near his. Then, when the slaves were gone and the 2 couples faced him, he launched right into the heart of the problem that faced the Cobbs. When our ancestors settled Edisto, English law required that family estates be handed intact to the eldest sons. In South Carolina, that's no longer the law, but we Cobbs and other families of ancient repute still honor it. Just as my father turned the plantation over to me rather than to Septimus, so that I could perfect the Sea Island cotton which has made it flourish, so now it must go to Persifer, who will make the decisions that will enable it to prosper in the new decades. He nodded to Persifer, who nodded back, taking at the same time Tessa May's hand in his. "When responsibility was given me," he said slowly, looking now at Somerset, "my younger brother Septimus felt that a great wrong had been done, and, as you know, he hied himself off to Georgia, a terrible self-banishment. I could never persuade him to return, and there he rotted in the wilderness." Tears of regret did not come to his eyes, but he did wipe his lashes, for he knew that tears might come at any moment. "Somerset, I know this must be a difficult situation for you, because you had reason to suppose that your brother would spend his life in the military. That was not to be. He's home, and the responsibility becomes his. I know you'll accept it gracefully, and I do not want you to scuttle off to Georgia like your Uncle Septimus. I beg you to stay and assist your brother in running our very large plantation. He needs your help, and so do I." Neither Somerset nor Millicent volunteered any response. From the time they received that letter more than a year ago, in which Persifer first suggested that at the end of the year he was going to quit the service, They had known that this day of decision would inevitably be upon them, and they had often discussed it quietly between themselves, never letting Tessa May or the old man know how deeply concerned they were. They had even gone so far as to send Cousin Reuben in the hill country of Georgia a secret inquiry. What is the quality of land in your district, and how difficult is it to grow short staple? He had replied enthusiastically, which they had to discount because everything Reuben did was marked with disproportionate enthusiasm, that a man was a darned fool to waste his energy on worn-out Carolina plantations making £300 an acre when his good fields in Georgia were making 550. He had added a paragraph which bespoke ancient grudges. A man is stupid, insanely stupid, to believe that he is somehow socially superior if he grows a few pounds of long staple cotton with its easy black seed, while his neighbor in Georgia grows an immense crop of short staple with its difficult green seed. The world of cotton is dominated by the short staple men, and if you have any sense, you'll become one of us. But such gnawing decisions were relegated to the shadows that evening when Maximus Cobb entertained the Charleston elite in his home by the sea. Now the big gates at the rear were thrown open. Six slaves in blue livery guided the broughams and phaetons as they deposited the plantation gentry at the long porch. Suetonius, in gorgeous attire suitable for a French palace, greeted each guest by title and name, and Trajan, in similar garb, led them to the punch table for their beginning glass. An orchestra played. Couples danced quietly both in the large room and on the porch. Candles in the glittering chandelier from Bohemia and refined whale oil in the lamps along the brocaded walls cast a soft light on the fine faces. Everyone seemed glad to have Persifer back home where he belonged. The two Cobb boys, as they would always be called while their father lived, passed among the guests, treating each with lavish deference, aware that one day soon they must find husbands and wives for their children from the families here represented. No Cobb within memory had ever married anyone not from Charleston. But if the Cobbs had to be polite to the guests against the day when they would have to seek marriage alliances, so did the guests, especially those with smaller plantations, have to be especially attentive to the Cobbs, for their children would represent the best catches in the 1850s. The evening was one of the most festive that the Cobb mansion had known in years, and it was capped when Maximus banged on the floor with one of his canes to announce, "We welcome home our son Persifer, mentioned in dispatches from the various battlefields in Mexico. Tomorrow he resumes stewardship of our plantations, and we wish him well." Glasses were raised, toasts to Persifer's success were drunk, and in every carriage that pulled out of the circular driveway at midnight, someone asked, "And what will young Somerset do now?" Young Somerset was the gentlemanly kind of man who would never challenge his brother's assumption of the Cobb plantations. But he was not allowed to surrender because his wife, Millicent, one of the sagest women in Charleston, would not. Under her coaching, he spent the closing months of 1848 outwardly calm, apparently preoccupied with the job of instructing Persifer in the complexities of the big plantation on Edisto, and inwardly contemplating a score of practical alternatives which Millicent kept placing before him. "You must see, Set," she said with unwavering determination, "we really have to leave, and I think it ought to be done before this year ends." "No, I'd never quit before the next crop is planted, but go we shall." They had six sensible choices, which Millicent reviewed whenever they talked, keeping them in strict order of preference. First, buy our own plantation near Charleston. But have we the money? Second, take over the Musgrave place, which their old people have suggested from time to time. Not directly, of course, but they have intimated. Third, manage one of the great plantations, of which there seem to be many, but I wouldn't care for that, and I'm sure you wouldn't either. Fourth, with Persifer leaving the army, you could join, but it could only be in the militia, and you'd have to start so low. Fifth, join your cousin Reuben in Georgia. But that sounds so desolate after you've known Charleston. Sixth, pull up stakes and move to fresh new land, new friends in Mississippi. Unemotionally, and always willing to explore even the more distasteful alternatives, they analyzed the positives and negatives of each solution and found themselves on dead center, almost equally doubtful about each of the options. They were hindered in making a decision because they could obtain no clear understanding of how much money they controlled. Seth had a private bank account, of course, but it contained only $8,000. He had never received a wage and had no land of his own to sell. He had always assumed that when his father died, there would be ample cash to distribute between the two sons. But then again, there might not be, because a great plantation family like the Cobbs often had much land, many negroes, no cash, as the saying went. But now another Cobb woman entered the debate, never openly, never betraying her plot to anyone but her husband in the secrecy of the night. It was Tessa May, daughter of a family that had prospered only because it adhered tenaciously to one rule: get possession of a good plantation and never borrow money against it. In the darkness, she whispered, "Percifer, I'm glad you chucked the army. I needed you here at home. We must do everything to make Set and Lissa get out." "I wouldn't do anything." "Purse, it's them or us. Mark my words, if quiet Set stays around long enough, he's going to lose that modest charm and become a real bastard." "Tessa." "Keep applying pressure on him. I'll work on Lissa, but let's get them out of here."